Welcome to the third hour of the Roundtable. Thank you for being with us. The new book, Nature and the Mind, The Science of How Nature Improves Cognitive, Physical, and Social Well-Being, is just out, and we are thrilled to welcome the author, Dr. Mark Berman, a pioneering creator of the field of environmental neuroscience, who's discovered the surprising connection between mind, body, and environment, with a special emphasis on the natural environment. He has devoted his life to studying it. If you sometimes feel drained, distracted, or depressed, Dr. Berman has identified the elements of a nature prescription that can boost your energy, sharpen your focus, change your mood, and improve your mental and physical health. He also reveals how central attention is to all of these functions and how interactions with nature can restore it. His brand new book, once again, Nature and the Mind, is both an introduction to a revolutionary new scientific field and a helpful guide to better living. It is a pleasure to welcome Dr. Mark Berman back to the Roundtable. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for having me on the program.
It's a real pleasure to have you back, and I thank you very much for being here. So what brought you to want to look at this particular arm of science and about how nature improves not only the cognitive but the physical and social well-being as well?
I think it started with a class that I actually took with a mentor of mine, Steve Kaplan. And Steve and his wife, Rachel Kaplan, composed this theory called attention restoration theory, that interactions with nature might be able to restore or replenish our ability to focus, and that might help us meet our goals better, help us to have better self-control, help us to be more cooperative. And I thought it was just a really fascinating idea, because a lot of psychologists and neuroscientists tended to focus more internally on people. Could you train people's memory and attention better? Could you give people pharmacological interventions to make their memory or attention better? But very few people were talking about actually having people interact with different kinds of environments, and that different kinds of environments could actually improve our ability to focus, make us more reflective, and improve mental and physical health. So I just found that to be really, really fascinating. And I thought, you know, that's something I really would like to look into in more depth.
So these are natural reactions that we have. We can put ourselves into those situations, or they can come organically, I assume.
Yes. And, you know, I think a lot of people have the intuition that kind of being in nature, being in parks and green spaces and blue spaces, can be maybe good for our minds, good for our brains. But there were very few researchers that studied this topic in a really rigorous way. Oftentimes, people would just ask participants, you know, when you went on that walk in nature, did you feel better? Did you feel like you improved in your performance? And people would say, yes, I felt a lot better. I felt like maybe I could concentrate better. But we wanted to actually test this with some really objective measures and see, you know, do people's cognitive performance actually improve when they interact with nature, using very quantifiable metrics. And it turns out that we found that when people just went on a brief walk in nature, a 50-minute walk, 5-0 walk in nature, they can improve their memory and attention performance by about 20% versus going on a walk in a more urban environment. And it was just really, really fascinating, because a lot of people tended to think that our ability to focus and our attention and our memory is sort of a fixed trait, that you're sort of born with a certain level or ability to attend and a certain amount of memory capacity. And these results were saying, look, even after a short walk in a natural environment, you can actually improve your performance on these things. So that was a very kind of eye-opening result.
You talk about in the book that increasing the number of trees on your street can decrease cardio metabolic disorders like stroke, diabetes, and heart disease. So how do you prove that? How do you figure that out? And in your work and in the science, how is that determined?
Yeah, it's a great question. So what we did for that study was we had health data from about 32,000 people in the city of Toronto in Ontario, Canada, that asked people about their health. How healthy do you feel? But also, have you ever had a stroke? Do you have diabetes? Do you have heart disease? So we had health data on, 32,000 people. And then we also had data on where they lived. And we had an incredible data set from the University of Toronto Forestry Department, where they had cataloged every single tree on public land in the city of Toronto. So we had data from 580,000 trees in the city of Toronto. We knew the species of each tree and the diameter of each tree at breast height, which basically told us how old the tree was. And one of my students, Omid Cardan, basically looked at some forestry algorithms and calculated how much tree canopy each individual tree provided. And then we had another data set with satellite imagery where we could quantify all the trees that were like in people's backyards. So we had data for how much green space there was on public land and how much green space or tree canopy there was on private land. And then we basically just did a statistical analysis to see, is there any relationship between the amount of trees that you have in your neighborhood and health in the neighborhood? And we found, yes, that if you had 11 more trees of average size on your city block, that was related to a 1% decrease in these cardiometabolic disorders. So 1% decrease in stroke, diabetes, and heart disease. That sounds pretty modest, but to get that equivalent decrease monetarily, you'd have to give every household in that neighborhood about $20,000 and have them all move to a neighborhood whose median income was $20,000 wealthier, or make people about 1.5 years younger. So it's very hard to make people healthier. It's incredible that 11 trees was related to better health. Now, we can't draw strong causal conclusions because in a bad case scenario, maybe healthier people just choose to live in neighborhoods that have more trees. But because of our statistical analysis, those healthier people could not be more educated, could not be wealthier, and could not be younger because we controlled for that. So it's a nice statistical relationship, but ideally we would move people to different neighborhoods or plant more trees in different neighborhoods and see how that impacted health. But that's very difficult to do. There was a study that you may be familiar with in the 1980s that Roger Ulrich did, where he looked at a single hospital corridor in a hospital in Philadelphia, and he was looking at recovery from gallbladder surgery. And some of these rooms on this single hospital corridor had views of modest nature, like some trees and some grass. And other rooms on this hospital corridor had views of like a brick wall, like to the other side of the hospital. And what Roger found was that patients who were assigned the hospital rooms with the modest view of nature, they recovered from gallbladder surgery a day earlier, and they used less pain medication than the patients who were assigned the rooms that had the views of a brick wall. And what's interesting in this study is that the patients are just randomly assigned to the different rooms. So it's not the case that younger or healthier people get the rooms with the nature view. So there, you can sort of determine a more of a causal relationship because it's almost like people are randomly assigned to these different rooms, and just having the view of nature seems to have a significant impact on recovery from gallbladder surgery, which is pretty incredible.
How much does it depend on the individual in the sense of what they are capable of responding to?
That's also an excellent question. I would say that, well, let me answer it in two ways. So I think for the most part, these are pretty universal effects.
Right.
In fact, there was another study done looking at the emerald ash borer bug, which is a beetle, an invasive beetle that killed millions of ash trees in the Midwest. And some economists looked at this, an epidemiologist, and they found that 5 years after the emerald ash borer bug had, you know, decimated the ash trees in the Midwest, mortality rates increased, that there was an extra 28,000 deaths. And these deaths were due mostly to cardiovascular diseases that they think are related to poor air quality with the loss of those trees. And for that, I would say, I don't think there's any individual differences there. You know, that's just, you know, how clean the air is versus not. I don't think there's going to be a lot of individual differences. We do find, you know, some people don't say they don't like nature, that they'd rather be in more urban environments. But what's interesting, when we do some of our studies, it doesn't really matter so much if people like the nature interaction in terms of getting these memory and attention benefits. So we did a study where we had people walk in nature in June, and this was done in Ann Arbor, Michigan, when it was about 80 degrees Fahrenheit. People liked the nature walk. They showed really healthy memory and attention benefits. We also had people walk in January when it was about 25 degrees Fahrenheit. Participants did not like the walk, but they still showed the same memory and attention benefits as the people that walked in June. So you don't even necessarily even need to like the nature or the nature interaction to get some of these benefits. With that said, you know, it's possible that people who feel more connected to nature or feel more comfortable in nature, maybe they'll get larger benefits. But I would say at this time, I think pretty much anybody can gain these benefits.
Does the quality of, and I use the word, I use this word hesitantly, but does the quality of the nature matter in the sense of, if I'm taking that walk that you mentioned in the Adirondack Park, is that different than taking a walk in a park in Tucson, Arizona?
My short answer would be yes. I think it does matter. You know, not all natural environments are created equally. Not all urban environments are created equally. So if you're on a hike and it's really, really hot, or there's a lot of mosquitoes and it's very uncomfortable, I would not expect that walk to be very restorative. So you want to make sure that your basic comfort needs are being met when walking in nature. You bring up this other idea, you know, like in the Adirondacks or like Yosemite Valley. These are really awe-inspiring nature environments. I would definitely expect that the effects would be stronger in those environments. Unfortunately, many of us don't have easy access to those environments. So it's comforting to know that you can get some of these effects just going to your local park. But absolutely, we think, you know, the more immersive the natural experience is, the more interesting stimulation, interesting things to look at in the natural environment will lead to more benefits. And, you know, we did a study too, looking at, for example, having people watch a video going through a farmed field, you know, versus walking through a forest. And, you know, people don't really find walking through a farmed field to be very engaging or very restorative, even though it is natural. You know, you might not expect getting the same benefits there as you would walking on a nice trail through a forest. So I'd say not all natural environments are created equal. You'd want to try to interact with a natural environment that for sure was safe, but also that had a lot of kind of interesting stimulation to look at that won't be too boring.
When it comes to those interactions, how do we input them into our daily schedules, our daily lives, that allow us sort of the maximum of what you are talking about when it comes to this improvement of cognitive, physical, and social well-being?
Yeah, so one thing to be mindful of, and this is something that Steve Kaplan taught me, and that's part of his attention restoration theory, is that humans kind of have two kinds of attention. So one kind of attention is called directed attention, where you as the individual person are deciding what you're going to be paying attention to. And it's thought that that kind of attention is fatigable or depletable. And this is the kind of attention that we use a lot at work or at school, where maybe the thing that you're trying to focus on is not the most interesting task, but you're forcing yourself to attend to it. And it's thought that that kind of attention is fatigable or depletable, that you can only direct your attention for so long before you become mentally fatigued and you just can't focus anymore. And we've all had that sensation at the end of a long workday where you're kind of staring at the computer screen and you can't really focus anymore. That's the good time to take the break. That's different from involuntary attention, which is the kind of attention that's automatically captured by interesting stimulation in the environment. So bright lights, loud noises, those things automatically capture our attention, and you don't really have control over it. And it's thought that that kind of attention, involuntary attention, is not as susceptible to fatigue or depletion. So you don't often hear people say, oh, I'm so tired looking at that beautiful waterfall, I just can't look at it anymore. Or, oh, I can't watch this really interesting movie anymore, it's just too interesting, I'm getting too tired out, I have to shut it off. But the idea with direct attention restoration theory is that if you can find environments that don't place a lot of demands on directed attention while simultaneously having interesting stimulation to activate involuntary attention, you could restore or replenish this precious directed attention resource. Now, one other thing that I want to mention too that's important is that we think that the kind of stimulation that activates involuntary attention should be softly fascinating. So what do I mean by softly fascinating? Well, when I look at that beautiful waterfall, it attracts my attention. It's very interesting, but I can still kind of mind wander and think about other things when I'm looking at that waterfall. If I'm in Times Square, that's also really interesting. Lots of interesting stimulation to look at, but it sort of captures all of our attentional processes and doesn't let go, doesn't allow for any reflection or mind wandering, and it's kind of a harsh attentional capture. So we think that the kind of stimulation that captures our involuntary attention needs to be softly fascinating for it to have this restorative quality, and a lot of natural environments meet that criteria. So in our daily lives, when we're feeling mentally fatigued and we can't focus, that's the time to take the break in nature and not scrolling our social media feed or streaming something on a streaming service or, you know, scrolling the news feed or something like that. We think all of those activities are actually fatiguing. So you need to be mindful of when you're in that directed attention fatigue state, when you can't concentrate, when you might be a bit irritable, that's the time to take the break. Now, many of us don't have easy access to nature, but we find that you can even get some of these benefits looking at pictures of nature or watching nature videos or listening to nature sounds. The effects of that simulated nature are not as strong as the real thing, but it's good to know that looking at some of the simulated nature, you can get some of these benefits as well.
And my final question to you is, what does this say about, and you know, I know you know this, but I'm just going to say it for people who perhaps don't, but we're fairly crappy at taking care of nature. So can this help in that regard?
I really, really hope so. There's another theory for why interacting with nature is beneficial called the biophilia hypothesis. And biophilia means having a love of nature. And, you know, that theory was saying, you know, humans have this inherent love of nature. And because in the modern world, we're kind of being more separated from nature, we're not getting benefits. So when we reconnect with nature, we kind of satisfy our inherent love of nature. And I was always a little bit bothered by that theory because I thought, you know, if humans have such an inherent love of nature, maybe we would make different decisions in terms of how we care for nature, which is exactly kind of what you were insinuating. I'm hoping that this book and this research and other people's research will help to show that nature is not an amenity, it's a necessity. That we can't be our best selves, we can't be the most productive, we can't be the most cooperative, we can't be maybe the most human without interactions with nature, that this is not a luxury. We have to have it. And, you know, which means we have to protect all the existing nature that we have. And, you know, I'm not saying we should all move out of cities. Cities are good for lots of other reasons. They can be more sustainable. We find that there's more innovation in cities, and there's actually less depression per capita in cities. But cities were not designed with nature in mind. So we're hoping that we can actually inspire almost like a nature revolution, where we start putting more nature into cities. We put more nature around schools, and maybe in schools, in our homes, in our workplaces. That, again, this isn't just an aesthetic, that it looks nice, that it actually has fundamental impacts on our mental and physical health that's really, really critical for human well-being.
The name of the book, Nature and the Mind, The Science of How Nature Improves Cognitive, Physical, and Social Well-Being. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Dr. Mark Berman, it's a great pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you very much for sharing with us this morning.
Well, thank you for having me on the program. I appreciate it.
Be well. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, Nature and the Mind, by Dr. Mark Berman. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.